When it comes to stem cell transplants, the theory sounds simpler than the implementation. Depending on the type of transplant, the treatment can be lengthy and feel taxing for patients. From risk to recovery, what details should you know about the process of stem cell transplantation and what outcomes can you expect? Here to spell it out is Dr. Leslie Lehman, Medical Director for International Hematology, Oncology, and Bone Marrow Transplants at Boston Children's Hospital, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and Associate Director of the Pediatric Stem Cell Transplant Center at Dana-Farber Boston Children's Cancer and Blood Disorder Center. This is the third episode in a five-part series from Boston Children's Hospital about stem cell transplants, where a Boston Children's expert brings you answers. I'm your host, Prakash Chandran. Dr. Lehman, thanks once again for joining us. I wanted to get started by asking you to explain for us the process of stem cell transplantation. Tell us what are the various steps and what types of tests are given.
So I'm going to start with allogeneic bone marrow transplantation, which is when you are using a donor, because it is more complicated and I think something that isn't quite as intuitive. So first, we have a patient who has a disease for which transplant offers the possibility of the best outcome. So we have to do a couple of things. First, we need a donor. And so the donor has to be a tissue typing match. And we start by looking in the family. Any one sibling has a 1 in 4 chance of being a full match, just like the peas that you studied in high school where you do the different crossing of the chromosomes. We look in the family. And just for people to know, the tissue typing can be done from a blood draw or even just from a cheek swab like they do in the crime TV shows. So having your family members or a younger sibling tissue typed is a very easy thing. We just, do a Q-tip along the cheek. And if there's a donor in the family and the donor is healthy and old enough, which really for a child patient, the donor only needs to be about a year old. We can use very small donors. Then we would go with that family donor. If the patient doesn't have a donor in the family, then we explore other options. We look in this 20 million plus unrelated donor pool. We can look in the unrelated umbilical cord blood donor pool. And now a newer technology is using half matches, and that is a mother and a father are both a half match, and those are called haplotransplants. So we can look at the mother and father and see if we would use those as a half match. The outcomes aren't still quite as good as they are with using a fully matched sibling, so that would always be our preference. But the first step is you identify a donor. And the second step is you have to make sure the patient themselves is healthy enough for the procedure. And so we look at them from top to toe, as I tell families. So we make sure their teeth are okay because we don't want a dental infection going into transplant. And we make sure their heart and their lungs and their kidneys and their eyes and their ears. We look at everything, and all those tests together take 2 or 3 days to do. And then we also do blood work on the patient to make sure they don't have any infections that we don't know about, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, of course, and that there's not an infection that will come back to haunt us during transplant. So that's sort of all the preliminary work that we do to get done. And then we have to prepare the patient for the transplant. And we call that conditioning. And the patient gets admitted to the hospital and they end up getting pretty high doses of chemotherapy to destroy their own blood stem cells so that they have room and they'll be willing to accept the stem cells of the donor. And it's usually high doses of chemotherapy. Sometimes radiation therapy to the whole body is involved as well. And you need to be in the hospital in order to get that. And then once you've gotten that, we take the donor's marrow and we infuse it in. And it's one of the miracles of transplant, which I say is that you just put it in like a blood transfusion, and those blood stem cells circle in the blood and know to get off and go in the marrow and set up shop. It literally looks just like a transfusion, and we give the donor product. And from that time, it takes about 3 to 4 weeks for those blood stem cells to get out of the circulation, go in the marrow, find that to be home, and start making new blood products themselves. And then they will start making white cells, red cells, and platelets that are from the donor, but are being made in the bone marrow cavity of the patient. And when that starts happening and is robustly shown to be going on and there's no infections or other kinds of complications, that's when patients start getting ready to go home. Most of the complications come either from these high doses of chemo and or radiation therapy we need to give because it can hurt your organs or can make you vulnerable to infection, or from the donor's immune system not liking the patient, even though they're a match or pretty close to a match, depending on what our options are, and sort of attacking the patient, and that can cause complications as well.
Yeah. So it sounds like a multi-step process, and we just reviewed the allogeneic one. So for the autologous, I imagine it's a much shorter process because you don't have as many parties involved. Talk a little bit about the various steps and what people can expect with that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's a shorter process. Usually we do it for, say, a lymphoma in a child or adult. And so we collect the patient's own blood stem cells, and that's usually after a cycle of chemotherapy, and we collect those from the peripheral blood. You don't have to go to the operating room and get it done out of your marrow, like donating platelets. You're hooked up to a apheresis machine, the blood comes out, the stem cells are plucked off inside the machine, the rest of your blood goes back into you. And then we freeze them. And you have to have a cell processing lab that's accredited and credentialed, which we obviously do at Boston Children's Hospital. And then usually you get some more regular chemotherapy. And then when your disease is in good control, but you need the top off of one last round of really strong chemotherapy, you get admitted to the transplant unit and you get, again, high-dose chemotherapy like you would give in the other kind of transplant. And the goal is that it wipes out your own marrow. And instead of waiting for your own marrow to recover, and it would be slow and potentially damaged, you take these previous cells that you've collected that had not seen as much chemotherapy and are stored, and you thaw them and you infuse them back in again, just like a blood transfusion. The neat thing is, because they're yours, you don't need to worry about the donor matching or any immunosuppression or anything like that. It's usually really only about 3 to 4 weeks in the hospital instead of the 5 to 6 weeks that it is for allogeneic transplant.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the length of the process. So you're saying 3 to 4 weeks in the hospital as opposed to the 5 to 6 for with allogeneic. But I imagine with the process in total for the allogeneic can even take longer than that, right?
Absolutely. So for allogeneic transplant, what happens is you're in the hospital a little bit longer, and then the new marrow is making red cells, white cells, and platelets. So that's all very good, and you can go home. But it's still somebody else's immune system in a different body. And so for 6-ish months, give or take, you're on immune suppressive therapy so that that new immune system in you is numb in the beginning. And then we wean that immunosuppressive therapy off over a period of 3-ish months and let it wake up. And then if all goes as is planned, and for the vast majority of pediatric patients, it's like, oh, this is good enough. This is like home. I'm going to settle in. And then ultimately, the patients don't need to be on any medication. So if a transplant is successfully navigated, which is the majority of them in the pediatric population for sure, by about a year after transplant, you're not taking any medications and you have a fully functioning bone marrow, which is both making your red cells, white cells, and platelets, but also making all the elements of your immune system.
It's absolutely amazing. So they can expect, you know, 6 to 9 months of true recovery after it's all done. How about for the autologous transplant?
Yeah. So because they don't have to take immunosuppression or anything, when they go home from the hospital, so they're in a week getting the chemo, we call the day for auto or allo, when we put in the stem cells, we call that day zero, because that's when the clock starts ticking to recovery. And so they usually go home about day 15, 16, 17. So in the hospital, about 3 or 4 weeks, because they were getting the chemo before. And when they go home, they're still feeling tired and maybe having a little nausea, but feeling pretty good. And by 2 or 3 months after transplant, you know, they're back to normal. Kids are incredibly resilient. And I want to be clear that this wouldn't be the same if you were 60 having this done. But for our 3 and 4 year olds, like 2 months after transplant, you wouldn't know that they'd had one.
So I wanted to move on and talk a little bit about the risks associated with these transplant procedures. Could you break down both the allogeneic and the autologous transplants?
We can start with the autologous. So autologous, you know, when we give you that strong chemotherapy during the period until your old bone marrow that we put back in you starts working, you are at risk for infection because you have no immune system during that period of time. And then always giving high dose of chemotherapy, it can hurt organs. It ends up preferentially hurting certain organs that we sort of understand why, and it's certainly proven to be true. And those are the kidneys and the liver and the lungs. And so you can end up with complications in those organs or those organs not working as well. Almost always they recover. Well over 90% of children successfully navigate an autologous transplant. And then once you're discharged from the hospital, the chance of having a complication acutely related to the transplant is really quite low. Now, down the road, to a growing body, which is a child, giving these high doses of chemotherapy. You know, transplant hasn't been around that long, but the more we look at people who had a transplant when they were 4, autologous transplant, and now are 20 or 30 or 40, the more we're seeing that, you know, it does take some toll on your heart or on your lungs or on your kidneys to have received these high doses of therapy when you were young. Again, mostly that you can't tell just looking at someone, but if we do sophisticated measures, we can see that your kidneys aren't as happy as if you hadn't had that transplant. And how much of it is the transplant and how much of it is chemotherapy you'd gotten regularly for the condition is still being sorted out. So that's the autologous group. For the allogeneic group, I like to think of the complications. I'll go over them a little more organizedly than I did the last time. You know, so during the transplant, just like for the autos, you're at risk for infection and you're at risk for lung, liver, and kidney toxicity. And then when you recover, you have that added risk of the donor immune system not being happy in you. And we call that graft, which is the donor cells, what we put in, versus host, which is the patient disease. And that new immune system can be, this isn't home, or this isn't close enough to home for me to be happy. And it can attack the skin and cause a rash, the GI tract and cause diarrhea, or the liver and cause liver abnormalities. Those are the three main organs. So the differences between auto and allo transplant are that there's some risks that are shared by both because you're giving strong chemotherapy and it can hurt the organs or make you prone to infection. The difference is that in allo, you're introducing a new immune system into a person. And hopefully by picking a donor who's a good match, it all goes very smoothly and the new immune system is happy in the new host. But sometimes it isn't. More likely if it's not a perfect match, but sometimes even when it is a perfect match for reasons we don't completely understand. And then the new immune system is like, not right, I'm not where I should be, and can attack the skin, GI tract causing diarrhea, skin causing a rash, and liver causing abnormal liver function tests because it's angry. It's saying, I'm in a foreign place. And we then have to give more immunosuppressive medicines to try to calm it down. And often that works, but there's a small number of people where they never quite end up in sync. They're not simpatico, we say. And you end up needing to be on immunosuppressive medicines for a long period of time, months, sometimes even years. And that new immune system can damage permanently the liver or the GI tract or down the road, even the lungs, and leave people with permanent dysfunction in those organs. And that is the main risk in a way, and why we always think very carefully and make sure that transplant offers more benefit that makes it worth assuming those risks, and why a transplant conversation is never a one-time conversation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So just before we close here today, I'd love for you to tell us about your center at Boston Children's specifically and what makes the process there so unique.
So we have such an amazing center at Boston Children's Hospital. I think it is because we are truly multidisciplinary, and two, we have the advantages of both Boston Children's Hospital, which is a quaternary children's hospital that offers every service. So we have a spectacular ICU, the most sophisticated gastroenterology service in the universe, top-level immunologists, and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, which is an NCI-designated cancer center. So we have incredibly up-to-date evolving knowledge about how to attack malignant diseases and how to make the immune system do what you want it to do. So that's a very special combination that is quite unique to have that partnership. Going back to my first point, the team is multidisciplinary, is that our nursing, pharmacist, physician, social worker, child life specialist, resource specialist team meet always. We really are family. We all know each other. We all have our roles and work together. And everybody addresses their part of the problem and takes in the input from the other people, you know, looking at the problem, and it ends up being, you know, the epitome of family-centered care. And our outcomes are benchmarked against other transplant centers by the National Marrow Donor Program. It's one of the initiatives that they do. And we are, you know, always in the top performers of the pediatric transplant centers. We're compared against other pediatric transplant centers. And I think that's a result of this multidisciplinary care that we provide.
Well, Dr. Lehman, I think that's the perfect place to end. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to part 3 of our stem cell transplant series from Boston Children's Hospital. For more information about the Dana-Farber Boston Children's Stem Cell Transplant Program, U.S. patients and referring providers can call 617-632-3961 or email ped.dfci.harvard.edu. For international patients and referring providers, you can call 1-617-632-2952 or email ped.international@dfci.harvard.edu. Thanks again for listening. My name is Prakash Chandran, and we'll talk next time.